The takahe, or Natornis, represents one of the world's greatest conservation success stories. Once declared extinct twice, they were rediscovered in 1948 by Invercargill Dr. Geoffrey Orbell, who found a small population in a remote valley in Fiordland's Murchison Mountains, Te Puianoa, above Lake Te Anau. One of the greatest ornithological moments in history, it's been called. Zoologist, writer and broadcaster Alison Balance, who's had a long association with the Kakapo Recovery Programme, has now told the story of the recovery programme of the takahe in a book called Bird of Dreams, a tribute to Geoffrey or Doc Orbell's famous rediscovery, which resulted in New Zealand's longest-running endangered species programme. Alison's with us now. Kia ora.
Kia ora, Kim.
What an extraordinary thing that must have been. He knew he'd heard them, right? So he set off with a few companions into the Murchison Mountains, bent on a sighting.
Well, he'd been bent on a sighting since he was about 10 years old, because he had seen a photo of a takahe specimen in the Otago Museum, and his mum told him it was extinct, and he didn't want to believe it was extinct. And he had been obsessing over this bird of his dreams since he was 10. And then in the 1948, it all started to come together, and he had gone into the Murchison Mountains because he'd worked out that that was probably where the birds were. He had a map on his wall and he'd marked all possible sightings, and there was this place in Fiordland, Te Puianoa, where he thought that's where they'll be. And on an earlier hunting trip at Easter, he and his young companions, Rex and Neil, had heard something that they said sounded like somebody blowing across a 303 cartridge, which was not a sound they recognised. And they found some mysterious footprints on a sandy beach. And what I love about that bit of the story was he thought it was probably takahe, but dusk was closing in on them and they needed to rush out of the mountains before it got too dark. So he drew up, he sort of memorized what the footprints looked like, and he marked on his pipe how long the prints were, because he said, that's the one item that I always have on me and I'll never lose. And he took it back and showed it to some experts who were less convinced than he were that it was Notornis. But he gathered his forces again, including on his next time in November 1948, Joan Telfer went with him as well. And they went back to that valley, to the lake where they had found these footprints. And he was determined to take photographs and movies. So he had a little movie camera. He had a still camera. They had some fishing net. And they left at dawn and they climbed up past the newly discovered glowworm caves, and they got up into this valley, and basically they came across Notornis straight away. There were two birds wandering around near the beach, and the team circled them, took some movie footage first, took some photographs, circled them, captured them, had lunch, even though it was only just 9:30 in the morning because they were so excited, and then they raced down the hill and drove rapidly back to Invercargill, where Dr. Geoffrey Orbell was a doctor, to break the news to the Southland Times, who were somewhat underwhelmed and didn't realise the significance of what these people had just discovered. And so they sent a cub reporter around to report on it. And then the news just went ballistic. It was reported, it was headlines around the world. Because as you said, takahe had been declared extinct twice.
When was the first time?
Well, the first time was... So takahe were first discovered as a species in 1847. A geologist, Walter Mantell, found some subfossils in a midden in Taranaki and sent them to Richard Owen, he who described them more. And in 1848, Richard Owen said, I call this a new species, Notornis, the southern bird, and it's probably extinct. And there were a couple of specimens found in the next 2 years, but Walter's dad, Gideon, who was a very famous geologist as well, wrote a book, used Notornis as the frontispiece, and he said, this bird is extinct. And then there were two further specimens collected in the late 1800s and a partial specimen. And then it was written off again in the early 1900s. And so by the time Orbell and his colleagues found it, it had been again nearly 50 years since anyone had officially seen a living takahe.
I think we're fairly certain that the North Island Takahe is extinct. Do we know if it was distinctly different from the South Island Takahe?
The Moho or North Island Takahe, that was the one that was first described by Richard Owen. So he called it Notornis mantellae after Roger Mantell. And then later on, a German museum director recognised that the South Island specimens were quite different. So, yes, we had two Takahe species, North Island and South Island. So the South Island one, I hope people know what it looks like. If it doesn't, it looks a bit like a supersized pukeko.
Yes.
Stocky.
As those people who were supposed to be culling the pukeko found to their cost because they ended up killing Takahe, which was just terrible.
Oh, yes. That was a disaster on Mototapu Island. But if you see a pukeko, are much smaller and finer. So,
and they can fly.
And they can fly. And Takahe very clearly can't fly, although they must have flown here originally. So the evolutionary evidence is that they arrived here about 2.5 million years ago. Probably their ancestor is probably not the Australasian swamp hen. There's suggestions that they're more closely related to the African swamp hen. So I'm not sure how the African swamp hen ended up here. But classic island story, they got here, discovered a land of opportunity. So they realized they didn't need to fly. And so they became big and flightless. So a Takahe is about 2.5-3 kilos in size and very stocky. The Moho, the North Island Takahe, didn't arrive until about 1 million years ago, whatever its ancestor was, flew across here and started a similar trajectory, becoming giant and flightless. It actually weighed a bit more than the South Island Takahe, so it was about 4 kilos, but it was taller and not so stocky. And basically, we know that bird from its bones, and there is one unsubstantiated rumour that someone saw one in the 1890s in the Tararua, but other than that, we've never seen a live one.
You've got a very nice description of the South Island Takahe here, described by a leading American ornithologist as resting comfortably in the company of elephant birds and more, as one of the world's most strange and wonderful avian beasts. They're the size of a fat turkey. They're elegantly colourful, a mix of purple, blue, dark blue, turquoise, emerald, olive greens, a white rump, a startling red bill, and legs. Most New Zealand birds have subtle, even dull coloration, which is pretty euphemistic way of saying dull. But not the Takahe. The bill and the prominent frontal plate above it looks industrial strength, while the sturdy legs are worthy of a rugby player. They do look very staunch birds, and they could probably give you quite a nip if they chose to, couldn't they?
If they chose to. I like to think of them as birds that have a great dignity. They've got a real gravitas about them, and they're very focused birds. They really like eating. They're actually quite different in colour from pukeko. Gary McCormick apparently described them as a pukeko with middle age spread. But I think they're much more than that.
Some places, and you've got listed a number of places where they are being bred and where they've been located. Some places like Zealandia, where I've seen pukeko, takahe, and you're right, they are strangely dignified. And Pukaka Mount Bruce, their retirement and advocacy sites. What does that mean? Birds that are beyond the breeding age?
Simply put, yes. So with the Takahe conservation story, it's gone from being a bird that basically made its last stand in the Murchison Mountains. It was once quite widespread around the South Island, but never abundant. So it's a bird that lives in grasslands and subalpine tussock lands. And it's an edge bird. So you probably found it around the edges of wetlands, on the edges of forests. And as stoats made their way across New Zealand and as there was competition with deer, basically the Murchison Mountains was the last place this magnificent species found a home. And in the last 75 years, the Department of Conservation and its predecessor, the Wildlife Service, have worked very hard to try and move the birds not just not just having a remnant population in the Murchison Mountains, which is a tricky and difficult place to be a Takahe. You know, it's a dangerous place to be a Takahe, as well as being an exceptionally good place to be a Takahe. So they've moved birds out to new sites. So initially they moved them to Pukaha, Mount Bruce and the Wairarapa as part of a trial captive breeding program. And then as the numbers have grown, they've created a new site near Te Anau where they breed and raise Takahe. And as this, and they've moved them to various islands. So they started with Maud and Mana and Kapiti and Tiritiri Matangi. They're on Motu Tapu at the moment. And then they had a real revelation, which was that this was a bird that, A, you can move from one quite extreme environment to quite a different environment. Which
much
is,
more adaptable. Yeah, much more adaptable than the Kakapo.
Yeah, but then there was also the opportunity to have this bird in places where people could see it. It didn't just need to be a mysterious bird hidden in Fiordland. It could actually be a bird that people can see and learn about and be delighted by at places like Zealandia and Wellington.
Do we know how many would have been in that first population that Dr. Rawbell found?
We don't have an exact number for how many existed in 1948 when they were rediscovered. Probably a couple of hundred. It's very hard to tell. What the early researchers discovered was that Takahe leave a lot of feeding sign. So I better explain Takahe feeding. I've already said they like eating. They spend 90% of their time eating. In the Murchison Mountains, they eat tussocks, Kynocloa snow tussocks. And they pull out a tiller. So a tiller is just about three or four leaves together in a single stem. They yank this out with that really big, strong red beak, delicately hold it in 1 foot, and nip off just the bottom 2 or 3 centimetres of the tussock tiller, which is the juiciest part. And then they throw the rest of the tiller away. And they're very selective at their feeding. They can very quickly work out if it's a good tussock bush with lots of nutrients. And if that's the case, then they'll eat quite a few tillers. Otherwise, they'll just eat one and go, oh, I don't like this bush very much. And so they leave behind them. So if you imagine that they're eating for 90% of the time, they leave behind them a mown strip, basically, of tussock tillers everywhere. And one of my favourite bits of the book is in the 1980s, Peter Moore decided to work out exactly how much a Takahe eats and what goes in must come out. So they had the three first successfully hand-reared Takahe chicks in Te Anau, and they fed them a certain amount of food each day, tussock tillers and grass, and they gave them so many thousand tussock tillers and grass stems. And then at the end of each day, they counted everything that came out. So a Takahe eats its half its own body weight every day in tussock and grass, which is about 1.8 kilos of the stuff. They've got a very short digestive tract. So basically what goes in comes out looking almost the same. And so they excrete, to put it politely, droppings that look a bit like miniature hay bales, about 10 centimetres long, and they poo once every 10 minutes. And so over the course of a day, they'll leave a 9-metre trail of droppings. And so if you're in Te Anau, in the Murchison Mountains rather, trying to work out how many Takahe you've just got droppings and discarded tillers everywhere. But there was probably a couple of hundred. At one point, the population did crash down to nearly just over 100 birds, basically. At the moment, we're up to 475, and it will pass 500 this year.
Is there a magic number where we can declare that they're all right now?
They try to do that with species all the time. They often talk about having 500 breeding pairs. We got 500, it'll be 500 birds this year. That, more importantly, you need to know how many breeding pairs, because you've got lots of young birds or these retired birds that don't breed anymore. We don't know what the magic number is, but basically the more big populations you can have, then the better off you'll be. And for Takahe, they're actually genetically very well off. They've managed to avoid the kind of bottleneck that things like our Chatham Island Black Robin or the Kakapo have been through.
I wonder why.
Sheer good luck, I think.
Burwood where they started captive rearing, I think. They used hand puppets. And that stopped in 2010. And the captive rearing has become less productive, I think, once they're released. What's the story?
So there was a long history of trying to captive breed takahe, which began in the late 1950s with Elwin Welsh, who was a farmer and keen aviculturalist at Pukaha Mount Bruce. That's why that centre came about. And he tried to rear takahe chicks. He tried to do it with eggs initially, and that didn't work. And then he went down and they got four small chicks. And he had trained bantams on pukeko chicks. And so these, the first hand-raised takahe chicks were raised by bantams. They even took the bantams down into the Murchison Mountain, so that when they retrieved these chicks, the bantams were ready to sit on them and keep them warm and keep them fed, which is delightful. But that breeding program really never took off. It didn't quite manage to get going. So in the early 1980s, they set up a captive rearing program, as you say, at Burwood, where they were puppet rearing, because they didn't want these birds to be imprinted on people. And so they would keep the tiny chicks in a enclosure which had one-way glass. They had a fiberglass model of a takahe mum who with a heating pad underneath, and she played pre-recorded sounds that a takahe mum or dad, because they both incubate their chicks, would make to their babies. And the babies would sit under that, and then the wildlife service officers would come along and they'd put a hand puppet on and little takahe beaks on their index finger and thumb and feed the chicks through a hole in the wall. And they produced over 25 years about 250 chicks, but they realised by the end of that 25 years they'd always had some concerns. Are these captive-reared chicks as good as wild-reared ones? And they eventually decided that although you could put these birds in all sorts of places, including back in the Murchison Mountains, and although they were very good at surviving, and they appeared to lay eggs and raise chicks, they actually raised half as many chicks.
Why do you think that is?
Don't know. They've recently discovered that hand-reared kakapo males aren't as effective at mating either. So there's just something that's not quite right, even though they had changed the rearing program over the years so that as soon as possible they would put the takahe chicks with adults and other sub-adults, because they have to learn from their parents how to forage, particularly in winter when they have to dig up the rhizomes of a summer green fern called Hypalepis, when the snow is thick on the ground and they have to go in the forest. They don't know how to do that naturally, so they need to have some time with adult takahe. But for whatever reason, it just wasn't working properly. So they did a complete 90-degree turn and decided that since parent-raised takahe chicks were clearly much better at being takahe, they would let parents raise them. So these days, Burwood, the takahe centre there, is pretty much like a takahe farm. They call it the engine room of the recovery program. And the Department of Conservation staff there have about, I think they've got more than 20 pairs of takahe now, who live in big outdoor enclosures, predator-proof enclosures, because takahe are very vulnerable to stoats. And they let them, they just make sure they've all got fertile eggs and they let them raise them. And then those birds go to various places. And they're starting to do some quite big scale translocations. So in 2018, they moved 30 birds to the Hifi Track in Kaharangi National Park.
Do we know how those are getting on?
Well, not great. It's a bit wait and see. So 2018, two chicks were produced. That was a beech mast seeding year. They have successfully produced two more chicks this year, but there's been no successes in between. So it's red tussock, which is not great for takahe, and maybe that's not the right place. So they're looking at new places, like the Greenstone Valley at the head of Lake Wakatipu is probably the next big place they might move takahe to, and then possibly the Reese Valley.
Yeah, it's slow progress, but you're feeling positive about the future of the takahe.
I'm feeling very positive now. It's been a real roller coaster ride for Doc and the recovery team. The numbers go up and down. And the Murchison Mountains, that's because of stoats. Stoats will kill adult takahe. There was one year where they lost 47% of takahe in the
That's
Murchison Mountains
unbelievable, isn't it?
due to a
Because
stoat
they're
plague. Oh.
armed with those huge beaks, and the stoats can still kill them.
That's
Those
right. Although
stoats.
takahe, given a chance, will also kill a stoat.
Excellent to talk to you, Alison. Thank you. Lovely book, Alison Ballance, talking about takahe. And the title of her book is Takahe, Bird of Dreams.